Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Chris Nestrick of Christian Peacemaker Teams, who discusses some of the reasons why a slim majority of Colombian voters rejected a proposed peace agreement with leftist guerrillas that would have ended 52 years of war. Mary Catherine Nagel, an attorney and playwright, who explains why she believes the organized resistance challenging the Dakota Access Pipeline is part of a larger struggle to protect indigenous rights. And Adele Stan, senior Washington editor with Alternet.org, who examines the right-wing views of Libertarian presidential candidate Gary Johnson and the source of his funding. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Amnesty International claims Sudan has used chemical weapons against civilians in rebel-held areas of Darfur, the western province in the East African nation that has endured 13 years of deadly conflict. Human rights monitors cited satellite images and hundreds of interviews and concluded Sudan did use chemical weapons during its current offensive. The conflict in Darfur began in 2003 as ethnic clans rebelled against the Sudanese government. Reports quickly surfaced of brutal attacks on villagers by pro-government militias called the Janjaweed. In 2004, the United Nations adopted an arms embargo against militias and government troops in Sudan. The International Criminal Court has twice issued arrest warrants for Sudan's President Omar Hassan al-Bashir, who is accused of committing crimes against humanity and war crimes against the people of Darfur. Amnesty International estimates between 200 and 250 people have died since January from exposure to chemical weapon agents, including sulfur mustard and nitrogen mustard. Witnesses claim they observed chemical weapons were being dropped out of cargo planes, targeting areas where rebels were not present. Sudan, which denies using chemical weapons, is a signatory to the 1993 Chemical Weapons Convention, which declares their use a war crime. For 2 years, the United States and Russia effectively worked on controlling nuclear weapons and established an aid supply route for U.S. and NATO forces in Afghanistan. Yet U.S.-Russian relations crumbled in 2011 after a U.S.-led military coalition intervened in Libya in order to oust dictator Muammar Gaddafi. In Clinton's 2014 book titled Hard Choices, the former Secretary of State warned, "Don't flatter Putin with high-level attention. Strength and resolve were the only language Putin would understand." President Obama canceled a summit meeting with Russia after Putin granted asylum to NSA surveillance whistleblower Edward Snowden. But the Obama White House rejected Clinton's advice to take a more aggressive approach in Syria. During the Democratic presidential primary campaign last October, Clinton called for a no-fly zone over Syria, a position supported by many Republican war hawks. However, in recent congressional testimony, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Joseph Dunford, noted, "For now, for us to control all airspace in Syria would require us to go to war with both Syria and Russia." In the 2016 election campaign, the Asian American vote is gaining considerable attention, and activists are working harder to boost voter turnout in Asian communities where talk about politics is often discouraged. In 2012, President Obama won over 70% of the Asian American Pacific Islander vote, yet only 48% of Asian Americans voted that year. In 2010, with the emergence of the right-wing Tea Party movement, one-third of Asian Americans told pollsters they were too busy to vote. During the recent presidential primary campaign, two-thirds of Asian American voters said they were not contacted by Democratic or Republican campaigns, and many are first-generation immigrants and have trouble obtaining ballots translated into their native Asian languages. Many Asian Americans, especially the older generation, avoid talking about politics or engaging with socioeconomic issues. That apolitical culture was instilled in part from the persecution political dissidents suffered in many of the nation's Asian families left behind. However, young Asian Americans are now sounding off on the need to become engaged and using the ballot to pressure elected officials to listen to their community's concerns and priorities. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.
Although many polls conducted in recent weeks indicated that supporters of a proposed peace agreement between the Colombian government and the FARC guerrilla group would easily win the October 2nd national referendum, the deal was narrowly defeated. Complacency among the accord supporters, combined with hurricane-force winds that buffeted Colombia's coast on Election Day, contributed to a low voter turnout of less than 38%. Former Colombian President Álvaro Uribe, who campaigned to defeat the pact that was negotiated over 4 years, charged that too many concessions had been made to the guerrillas, including the offer of amnesty for war crimes committed by rebel fighters during 52 years of war. For their part, FARC's leadership maintained that they too had made concessions, such as dropping demands for radical land and economic reforms. Colombian President Juan Manuel Santos, who had negotiated the peace deal, said that the rebels and government will maintain the year-long ceasefire while negotiators from all sides of the conflict convene to salvage the chance for peace in a war that has killed an estimated 250,000 and displaced more than 6 million people. Your reporter spoke with Chris Nestrick, a project support coordinator with Christian Peacemakers Colombia team, who discusses some of the reasons why voters may have rejected the peace accord and his hope that a path to lasting peace will be found.
What we do know, and which is really important, is that if you look at the places that were most touched by the violence over the last 52 years, the places most victimized by the war, that those places did vote yes. They did vote yes for this peace agreement, and that we see in the cities and other places that are relatively safe from the at least the last, 20 years of the conflict, voting no. And so I think that's a really important mark of that, the victims want peace in Colombia, and they voted for it. I think that, the ex-president Uribe had a large political campaign encouraging people to vote no, and those reasons were, a lot of it, which aren't totally true, but saying that, the Las FARC and members of the guerrilla would receive amnesty for crimes. I think amnesty is one part of it, but people that did commit gross human rights violations were going to be sent to jail. And I think another thing is that part of the peace accords was a transitional justice that really focused on reconciliation, transitional justice for the victims of the war, rather than a punishment model where perpetrators would simply go to jail for anything they committed, but rather seeking ways to seek reconciliation within the civil population of Colombia. So a lot of people that supported Uribe rather have like a punitive type of justice done rather than a seek reconciliation between the victims and the perpetrators. And I think that was one of the reasons why you often hear that they're handing over all the human rights violations would be left in impunity, which isn't totally true if you read according to the accords. I think the other thing that happened there, and this is really interesting, is I think there was a part of the peace accords talked about the LGBTQ community as victims of the conflict, which is rightfully so. They've been targeted for social cleansing in the past, but that a lot of Christian churches, both Catholic and Protestant and evangelical, because it named LGBT community as particular victims of the conflict in a unique way, really felt like they couldn't support it because of that, which is really sad and totally disappointing, obviously.
Chris, I wanted to ask you about the intimidation factor. Are there armed right-wing paramilitary groups still in operation in Colombia that could have had an impact on this vote by intimidating and threatening voters who might have otherwise cast a ballot in favor of approving the peace agreement?
I haven't heard or read any reports around specific paramilitary intimidation with this national referendum. What I do know is that since the peace accords were announced at the end of August out of Habana, that around 15 human rights activists have been assassinated. We understand that on the ground is a direct relation to the announcement and paramilitary actors targeting human rights activists. The first person to be killed was someone on the ground that their farm was going to be used for the demobilization process, or one of the concentration zones where Las FARC was going to de-arm and give their weapons over and then enter civilian life. I think what we've seen is a restructuring and rising of paramilitaries and trying to get ready to take over the vacuum that will be left when, you know, the peace accords are finally. I still have hope that they're continuing to move forward, but I don't have any information right now about if that was influencing and so many people to vote no.
What is your expectation now that this referendum on the peace agreement has failed? Colombian President Juan Santos has said that he's going to be meeting again with FARC guerrillas to figure out what comes next. As I understand it, there was really no plan B in place to have a plan of action if the voters had rejected this referendum on the peace accord. And that, of course, has taken place now. What is your expectation for the next step?
A lot of people, including myself, we're not quite sure. You know, I think there's a lot of speculation around, you know, we do know that Las FARC EP have said publicly that they're not going to, you know, retake arms. You know, both parties are continuing to respect a bilateral ceasefire, and that Las FARC is totally committed to these peace accords. I think Juan Manuel Santos has said that he is going to meet with the Center Democratic Party to kind of rework and think about how to move forward in the peace accords. I think that there's a lot of victims in Colombia. I would say that, you know, the victims of this conflict deserve peace and deserve reconciliation.
That was Chris Nestrick, a project support coordinator with Christian Peacemakers Colombia team. For more perspectives on the failed Colombian peace agreement referendum, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. The Obama administration placed a temporary hold on further construction of the controversial Dakota Access Pipeline on September 9th. Thousands of indigenous opponents of the pipeline and their allies have established a protest encampment in North Dakota in order to stop the pipeline from crossing the Missouri River, which they maintain threatens sacred burial sites and the only source of drinking water for the Standing Rock Sioux tribe. But the company building the project, Energy Transfer Partners, has continued its preparation work on the project despite the Obama administration's request for a voluntary halt on both sides of the river. On September 27th, an indigenous attorney working on Native issues spoke at Yale University about the fight to stop the Dakota Access Pipeline and what it means for the Sioux and the broader fight for indigenous rights and sovereignty. Mary Catherine Nagel is a member of the Cherokee Nation and a partner with a Pipestem law firm, which is dedicated to protecting and enhancing the sovereign rights of tribal governments. She's also a nationally acclaimed playwright of indigenous-themed plays who has served as the executive director for Yale's Indigenous Performing Arts Program. Nagel began her talk at Yale with a quote from the chairman of the Standing Rock Sioux tribe.
History connects the dots of our identity, and our identity was all but obliterated. Our land was taken, our language was forbidden. Our stories, our history were almost forgotten. What land, language, and identity remains is derived from our cultural and historic sites. Sites of cultural and historic significance are important to us because they are a spiritual connection to our ancestors. Even if we do not have access to all such sites, their existence perpetuates the connection. When such a site is destroyed, the connection is lost. All of us are here in this room tonight because we agree that this is a powerful movement. It's an inspiring movement. It's a movement that is for Standing Rock, but we see a reflection of how it affects all of our lives. But at the same time, we are following their lead. Right? This is their movement. This is about their sacred sites. This is about their water. This is about the lands that they have been protecting for thousands of years. And I think it's really important to honor and recognize that, and that when we lend our voices to this movement, that we don't try to appropriate it for our own uses, which can sometimes happen, especially in the United States. The company's goal was to build right up to the edge of the water, kind of on both sides, so that they could say, well, look, Judge, you know, we've put billions of dollars into this. Are you really going to stop it now just because some Indians are upset about the water? And they even said, and so of course, in Standing Rock said, well, we've got, you know, it's not just the water is very important, but also it's our sacred sites and our burial grounds. Our people have been buried here for thousands of years, and you can't just dig that up and put in a pipeline. Well, the company's response was, well, show us where these sites are. You say they're sacred sites, where are these sites? So actually the Tribal Historic Preservation Officer went out, you know, a lot of this is private land now, even though it was historically treaty land and it was Standing Rock's, the Great Sioux Nation's land. He had to go get permission to go onto private land, identify where the sites are. After they filed a court document saying, you want to know where the sites are, here they are. The next day, this Dakota Access Pipeline Company moved its construction crew several miles to those sites to start deconstructing and constructing on those sites. So that's when the folks at the camp went out peacefully, no weapons, no threats of violence, to the equipment to stop them from purposely destroying the tribe's sacred sites. And that's when the company's private security force unleashed violent dogs who bit several people, including a pregnant woman, to attack them. Another thing that I think is really important that I personally bring in terms of my work is the relationship between our environment, our land, and our women, and our tribal sovereignty. A lot of our grandmothers and our aunties would tell us, you know, there's a reason she's called Mother Earth, right? She's our mother. This is one of my favorite quotes from Vanessa Gray. The land is our mother. So when we lose value for the land, people lose value for the women. And that's actually what we've seen in North Dakota. So the Bakken oil region, this pipeline is going to increase the amount of oil extraction in a region that has already boomed tremendously in oil production to the point that North Dakota is now number one in the United States for exportation of oil out of the state. And it's now become one of the top states in the country for sexual assaults, rapes, murders, and sex trafficking, particularly of Native youth. Another really important thing to remember that a lot of what's happening at Standing Rock is really powerful, and I think it resonates with a lot of people. And a lot of people are saying this is about climate change, and this is an environmental movement. And yes, in part it is, right? It is about recognizing climate change as a problem and an important environmental movement in the United States. But these aren't new ideas, right? Like, in our tribal communities, we've had these understandings for thousands of years. This is a restoration of what was taken from us, right? So this living in balance with nature and the land and water and respecting that water is what sustains us and that our bodies are 80% water and that we die without water, you know, is not a new idea. It is a restoration of what was eradicated to make a lot of things around us in the United States possible. But now we have this amazing opportunity, thanks to a lot of the folks, the youth and the tribal leadership at Standing Rock, to wake up and come back to something we knew a long time ago.
That was playwright and Indigenous rights attorney Mary Catherine Nagel. This segment was recorded and produced by Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus. For more information on groups opposing the Dakota Access Pipeline and how to support activists who are planning on spending the winter at the pipeline construction site, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. According to public opinion polls conducted over the last year, Democratic Party nominee Hillary Clinton and the GOP's Donald Trump are the two most unpopular presidential candidates in recent American history. The campaign has been marked by Trump's insults, appeals to hatred, and a celebration of violence targeting immigrants and other minority groups. After years of charges of dishonesty and arrogance churned out by right-wing Republican-affiliated groups, as well as a series of major missteps, Hillary Clinton has become a polarizing figure, losing much of her appeal as America's first female major party presidential candidate. With the disappointment that comes from the perceived dilemma of having to choose between the lesser of two evils, many voters have turned to support independent party candidates running this year, such as Libertarian Party nominee Gary Johnson and the Green Party candidate Jill Stein. Young, newly engaged voters, many of whom worked on behalf of Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders' campaign, are also considering casting a ballot for alternative candidates. Former New Mexico Governor Gary Johnson has had the most success this year in garnering support by appealing to both disgruntled Republican voters unhappy with Trump and disaffected Democrats disappointed with Hillary. But many voters don't know that Johnson and his Libertarian Party advocate a complete rollback of government, from the abandonment of student loans, environmental gun and health and safety regulations, to the privatization of public education and Social Security. Your reporter spoke with Adele Stan, senior Washington editor with Alternate.org, who examines Gary Johnson's views and the source of his funding, much of which comes from donors associated with the notorious right-wing activist Koch Brothers Network.
It's easy to be attracted to Johnson because of his favoring the legalization of marijuana and rhetoric, he's anti-war rhetoric that he has issued. Although, if you go back in his history, he wasn't always quite so anti-war. But let's just get to what his ideology is. I mean, the guy opposes federal guarantees for student loans, for starters. I mean, I can't imagine how anybody, I mean, it's bad enough people are coming out of school with these huge debts, but without those federal guarantees of those loans, nobody's going to get a loan. So how are you going to go to college, period? He opposes virtually all forms of gun control. He opposes the minimum wage. He opposes collective bargaining for public employees. He proposes cuts to Social Security, and he wants to remove Medicare and Medicaid from federal control, meaning like they would, quote-unquote, block grant this money to the states. He supports private prisons. I mean, come on. So this is who this guy is. We still don't know that he doesn't have backing of the Koch brothers in this current campaign. We do know that one of Donald Trump's key advisors, Roger Stone, advised Johnson's 2012 campaign. And we also know that Roger Stone is a big proponent of using third-party candidates as spoilers in the service of a major party candidate. You know, I think there are a lot of questions to ask about who's bankrolling Johnson and why they're keeping him out there when obviously he's got no chance of winning and very little in the way of an agenda that you could imagine either of the two major party candidates adopting if they don't already embrace it.
Adele, outline for our listeners where Gary Johnson's money is coming from and the clues that those sources of funds offer to the ideological agenda of Gary Johnson and his candidacy.
We don't know where all of his money is coming from. All I can tell you is where he's getting some of his money. And his two largest donors are very interesting guys. One is Jeffrey Yass. Jeffrey Yass runs an options trading group. So the Susquehanna International Group is run by Jeffrey Yass, and Jeffrey Yass is a huge proponent of the privatization of public education, a.k.a. charter schools, school vouchers, you know, all of these different ways of siphoning tax dollars into the hands of private and religious entities. So Yass has given $1 million to a Gary Johnson super PAC, that is called Purple PAC. Purple PAC was founded by Ed Crane. Ed Crane was the founding president of the Cato Institute, a very famous libertarian think tank. Yass sits on the board of the Cato Institute with David Koch, one of the billionaire Koch brothers. He also is part of this outfit called Students First, which is the project of somebody named Betsy DeVos. The DeVos family they're huge players in both the religious right and in the neo-libertarian business right. I mean, they want to deregulate government controls on business. At the same time, they're using their religion to impose controls on people's bodies. And DeVos comes out of the family, that's the family that owned Amway, which many describe as a pyramid scheme. And the DeVos family is also part of the Koch network. And what is the Koch network? It's a constellation of, I'm sure your listeners are familiar with, a constellation of all kinds of entities, think tanks, organizing groups, that Charles and David Koch both contribute to, but also bring all of their rich friends, who are also private capitalists, together to donate to, and the money gets passed around in ways that's untraceable. Now, the other guy who's giving big bucks to a Gary Johnson super PAC is a guy named Chris Roofer, who runs the Morningstar Packing Company in California, which is a tomato grower and processor. And Roofer is, you know, flat-out libertarian. He doesn't believe that any land he owns should have be, you know, subject to any kind of environmental regulation. He is currently been slapped with a $1.5 million fine by the Central Valley Water Control Board in California for pollution. And he has contributed to Gary Johnson super PAC that is promoting this idea that people who would ordinarily vote, be inclined to vote Democrat, can swap their vote for Johnson with somebody who would ordinarily be inclined to vote Republican, and it all even out in the wash, and it won't hurt either one of the major party candidates.
That was Adele Stan, senior Washington editor with Alternet.org and a columnist with the American Prospect. Find a link to Stan's recent article titled Meet Gary Johnson's Koch Network Money Men and related articles by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and support our show, which is celebrating 25 years on the air in 2016. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Denise Manzari, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.